The 3rd of March 1940, Sumner Wells meets with Goering in Berlin, who evades his inquiries about alleged cruelty to Polish Jews. Practical teaching is continued in the 20th letter, with the significant addition that the accompanying meditation changes from the rod of power to the use of the rod of power. A list of the meditation subjects that accompany the letters is given on page 149, and as Dion Fortune pointed out in her previous letter, their sequence is quite instructive. Letter number 20, for March 3, 1940. The rod of power, or diamond scepter, is a concept well known to those who study the secret tradition. No doubt in the past it was given symbolic form as a rod, possibly jeweled, but actually it is the trained mind of the initiate. In earlier letters we considered the ways in which ideals could be instilled telepathically into the group mind of a race by someone who was a member of that race, and who therefore had access to its group mind, living them out in actual practice with intention. It will be noted, however, that we have defined the rod of power as the trained mind of an initiate, not merely as the trained mind. An initiate, by virtue of his knowledge and training, is in touch with cosmic forces, and he makes himself a channel for their manifestation, his mind selecting and directing them. This is the real diamond scepter. For the use of this method, a group of trained and dedicated people is needed. The training is in the traditional method of the mysteries, whereby control not only of the mind but also of the magnetic forces of the etheric double is obtained. The dedication is first to the One, Unity, the Godhead, source of all being and measure of all good, and secondly to one or another of the great mystical orders that lie on the background of the different traditions. In our own case, the order is indicated by the symbol we use to open our meditation and pick up our contacts, and the tradition, it need hardly be said, is the Western. All the orders are brethren, however, and all the paths converge upon unity, the difference between them being indicated by the word tradition, which means that they have evolved under the influence of different types of culture. All who care to take the work seriously can be of help in this task and participate in its experiences. They can all form facets of the diamond scepter, helping with the transmission of the spiritual influences thus invoked. Once the link is made, the power is soon flowing spontaneously. Knowledge is needed to pick up the force and to direct it, and this knowledge is supplied by the leader of a group. But none who are sincerely dedicated to the love and service of man and God need feel that they are without value in the work. Naturally, the more knowledge and trained mind, power there is, the better, but devotion and deep spiritual feeling contribute to the work, something for which knowledge alone is no substitute. Those who have the knowledge necessary for the work need the help of those who have the devotion for its carrying out. Therefore, all who so desire can co-operate in a spirit of devotion, and those who are able to go further can have an opportunity to do so. The 10th of March 1940, meat rationing is introduced this week. Sumner Wells meets the King and Neville Chamberlain in London to discuss peace proposals. The 21st letter brings in the significance of the other two symbols, the sword and the cup, and the Dion Fortune shows how all three interlink into a composite glyph that takes the work on from immediate defense to positive long-term construction. Letter number 21, for March 11, 1940. We are now engaged upon a phase of our work which is not merely defensive but constructive, and defensive because it is constructive. We are, in fact, working out the formula of the new eon. We have already worked upon the symbol of the scepter, or rod of power, and interpreted it as meaning the secret wisdom employed to guide the affairs of nations. But there are two other symbols in the glyph, and we cannot understand any one of them in its full significance apart from its relationship to the other two. These two are the sword and the cup, made familiar to us in the Arthurian legend. Those who are instructed in the use of the symbolic method of meditation in conjunction with the diagram of the Tree of Life know that all symbols possess a fourfold significance attributed to the four planes of manifestation, and the diamond scepter is no exception to this rule. Upon the highest plane it represents the power that comes to a man when he knows the will of God and places himself in alignment with it, Upon the mental plane it represents the power that comes from a knowledge of the true nature of things. Upon the astral plane it represents the magical skill that controls and directs the astral forces. Upon the physical plane it represents the strength of the human will. This fourfold interpretation applies equally to the other two symbols that complete the triangle of force. Neither of these, however, can be understood apart from the other, for they are a pair of opposites. Each, taken separately, is a great half-truth, and so misleading. They must therefore never be considered apart. This, of course, is true of any symbol, which must always be considered in relationship to its opposite if a full understanding is to be obtained of its significance, for all manifestation is dual, unity being unmanifest. The sword and the cup, on the physical plane, represent the positive and negative forces of the universe and can, according to the method of the Kabbalah, be attributed to Chokhma and Bina. Upon the mental plane there, represents the scientific, critical, discerning intellect. The cup represents the imaginative, intuitive, artistic qualities of the mind. Upon the astral plane they represent the method of the occultist and the method of the psychic. Upon the physical plane they represent the masculine and feminine potencies, thus being the material reflections of Chokhma and Bina. Here we have a mass of symbolism that will afford food for meditation for many a long hour, gradually unfolding its significance as it is brooded over. To sum up briefly, the glyph as a whole refers to spiritual power, directed by occult knowledge, operating through the positive and negative forces of the universe upon all four planes of manifestation. We know that our work as a whole is concerned with the life of the nation. The glyph may therefore be taken as being a formula of regeneration for the race. The 17th of March 1940, after talks in Italy with Mussolini, Sumner Wells ends U.S. efforts to bring the war to an end and returns home. The first 6 months of weekly letters is brought to a fine close with the 22nd, which appears in the week of the vernal equinox of 1940. Here Dion Fortune spells out plainly the nature of the inner contacts that constitute the greater mysteries behind her work, the Rosicrucian tradition. Furthermore, she lays down the line of the importance of the Arthurian legend for future work, with particular emphasis upon the role of Merlin, as seen as a colonizer from a higher and older civilization. This work was indeed considerably developed in the years before her death, and most of this material I was permitted to incorporate into the secret tradition in Arthurian legend, Aquarian Press, 1983. Letter number 22, for March 17, 1940. When the group that meets on a Sunday at 3, QT meditated upon the direction in which the diamond scepter points, certain things began to come clear. It is obvious that we are dealing with Arthurian symbolism in the cup and the sword, and it would seem to fit in well with the nature of the glyph if we take the armed king on his battle charger in the red ray as King Arthur, and the throned king in the blue ray as Merlin, for Merlin undoubtedly was the lawgiver to the kingdom of Britain and his power was the power of the secret wisdom, as all legends attest. The work we are doing, as we already know, derives its primary contact from the Rosicrucian tradition, but its expression in the outer world will evidently be through the Arthurian branch of that tradition. It may seem strange to speak of the mysteries of the Grail as an aspect of the Rosicrucian tradition, which they long antedated, but for practical purposes that is correct. The Western esoteric tradition, as the mystical knowledge of the Christian nations is collectively called, consists, as do all esoteric traditions, of the greater and lesser mysteries. The Rosicrucian tradition is the repository of the secret wisdom of the ancient mystery religions, Neo-Platonism and alchemy. Those lesser mysteries of the Britons and the Celts, which are known to us as the Arthurian cycle of legends, derive according to both intrinsic and psychic evidence, from the ancient mysteries. A lodge of the lesser is always the pendant of a greater mystery temple, and as the Rosicrucian order is the lineal descendant and repository of the ancient mystery tradition, it is quite correct to speak of the mysteries of the Grail as part of the Rosicrucian tradition, for so they are at the present time, for the good and excellent reason that they cannot be worked apart from Rosicrucian knowledge. In the light of this explanation, it can be seen how our work has gradually unfolded like a flower growing from living roots, thus affording clear evidence of the truth of the claim that instructions for its carrying out are being received from the inner planes. We know, therefore, that whatever form our work will subsequently take, it will be expressed in terms of Arthurian symbolism and rooted in the Arthurian tradition. This affords us a further interesting piece of information, for the Arthurian tradition is closely linked up with the Celtic Church. The primitive pre-Roman Christianity in these islands, brought hither direct from the Holy Land by Joseph of Arimathea, the Graal bearer. This is to us a most important key, for our problem has been to maintain the Christian contacts while freeing ourselves from the misleading bondage of what M. Blavatsky so aptly termed church unity. In the primitive Christianity of these islands we touch something very simple and pure and very close to nature, for there were no disputes between the priests of the sun and the priests of the sun when the inspiration of the Graal first came to these islands, the one merged naturally into the other. Merlin was unquestionably a Druid priest and tradition declares him to be an Atlantean. King Arthur was equally unquestionably, and apparently with Merlin's full agreement, a Christian knight. Consequently we have a tradition of Christian chivalry with the ancient teaching of the Graal. Here is indeed a rich field for our tilling. From this source we can draw an inspiration that is native to these islands though not limited thereto. For the legends ramify all over Europe through the quests of the various knights. We may take it, then, that it is Merlin, the ancient wise one, who points with the scepter the direction in which we are to go. The 21st of April 1940 in Norway, Norwegian and British troops are forced out of Lillehammer by German forces. There was a period of relative inactivity following the vernal equinox of 1940. There had been a pause in the regularity of the weekly meetings as a result of the Whitsun holidays, and as Dion Fortune pointed out in her 23rd letter, it would take a week or two to build up to the previous momentum. The pause seems to have been salutary because, in the 25th letter, the atmosphere of serenity that pervades the group's headquarters, and that surrounds all who take part in the work, is commented upon. But at the same time loins are girded up for action in the formulation of an angelic patrol, not only around the immediate coasts of the British Isles, but extending far over the North Sea. Letter number 25, for April 21, 1940. It will be noted that the earth of England is still immune from the forces of destruction. In this connection I would like to point out the significance of certain things. Firstly, our headquarters at 3, QT is a center of peace, so much so that it is only when we leave its atmosphere that we realize how profoundly peaceful and completely safe, guarded that atmosphere is. It must not be thought that we are selfishly indifferent to the fate of our own and other nations when I say that for us at 3, QT the war might be non-existent so far as any mental strain is concerned. This is as it should be, firstly, because if it were otherwise, we could not be a center of radiation, and secondly because it proves that we are doing our work efficiently. Physician, heal thyself. If we were unable to maintain an atmosphere of serenity in our own head quarters, how could we hope to be a nucleus of stability for the group, soul of the nation? Moreover, we ourselves could not do the work that is required of us if we had not got an atmosphere of serenity to do it in. And not only is there an atmosphere of stability and serenity at our head quarters, but the meditation reports and letters of those who are working with us show that they, as individuals, find themselves stabilized and sharing in this serenity. They are in a remarkable degree individual nuclei of stability in a profoundly disturbed world. This stability is in part due to the power of steady meditation to neutralize uncoordinated vibrations. It is also no doubt due to our certainty of the outcome of the war, because the power of extended vision can see how things are going on the inner planes and deduce their outcome. This is not prophecy in the ordinary sense of the word, but just as a man on a high cliff can see a ship approaching the shore before it is visible to those at sea level, so, when we are able to perceive conditions on the planes of causation, we are able to announce the advent of events of which we have watched the causes. It is no vain or unverifiable boasting to declare that we have succeeded in building a sphere of psychic protection over our own head, quarters, and that, using the same methods, those who are co-operating with us have built the same kind of psychic bell, jar over themselves. It will also be noted that a similar kind of circuit of protection guards our shores. The life of these islands goes on in peace, for the tide of war is held back at high water mark. Thus it has been for the first vital 6 months of the war, when our defenses were in the making. Is there any reason to doubt that it will continue to be so now that our physical preparations are completed and ready for all eventualities? Germany, we know, had nothing to add to the readiness of her air force when war broke out. Meanwhile, with the war entering upon its active phase, we must continue to keep watch and ward of the astral ways, and we should again concentrate upon the angelic patrol of our coasts. But we might also try to advance our boundaries, and those who have a taste for psychic adventure might get a map, or mark out on a map, the long line of the mine fields that run from the far north down the coast of Norway, divide into two at the passage to the Baltic, and wall off both eastern and western sea boards of Germany. It may quite well be that Germany has received her last seaborne imports and we have heard the last of commerce raiders. Such a patrol will be stormy work, and only those with steady nerves should attempt it. In order to do it, a mental picture of the map of Europe in that area should be combined with a mental picture of the rocky shores or sandy coasts of the region patrolled. The experiment should first be made of patrolling the North Sea coastline, and only when it is proved possible to do this steadily and clearly should the attempt be made to carry the patrol through the narrow waters into the Baltic. The 28th of April 1940 this week, Germany officially declares war on Norway. Within 3 days the Allies are forced to evacuate 4,000 men. Their equipment has to be left behind. Immediately following upon the extension of their work, an added diamond cyan is found in the symbolic images that they had been formulating. In a sense this is an interesting development in the light of Dion Fortune's latter novels, and might well be seen as a higher aspect of the Isis contacts. Letter number 26, for April 28, 1940. A very interesting development of our work took place on Sunday, April 21, during the meeting in the sanctuary at 3:00 UTC. We built the cross, the cavern and the triangle as usual, and were contemplating the triangle with three figures in the rays, when it was seen that the third figure had, for the first time, become the focus of the meditation. It will be remembered that the red and the blue rays were taken respectively as Jeborah and Chst and the purple ray as Yezud, and that the mounted figure in the red ray, bearing the sword, was taken to be King Arthur, and the seated figure in the blue ray, holding the scepter, was taken to be Merlin. The third figure, standing in the purple ray and holding the cup, was taken to be the Master Jesus. Now this attribution presented certain difficulties, for the Master Jesus, being on an altogether different plane to King Arthur and Merlin, formed an unbalanced triangle unless he were taken as emanating the other two, and as the point of contemplation is from Malkuth, looking towards Yezud, it will be seen that this attribution presented difficulties which our workers may have discovered for themselves. Nevertheless, we had to take what we were given and do the best we could with it, waiting for its significance to unfold. In the meeting in the sanctuary, when the focus of the meditation at last came to bear on the purple ray, the riddle was solved. While contemplating, several of those present saw independently that the horizontal triangle had resolved itself into a three-sided pyramid with the figure of the Master Jesus at the apex in an ovoid of white light, from which the three rays emanated, and that in the third ray was the figure of the Virgin bearing the cup. This glyph balances perfectly. The Master Jesus is seen correctly placed on a higher plane, being at the apex of the pyramid and also at the center of the triangle in the Tifereth position, and this is true symbolism. The placing of the Virgin Mary in Yezud is also correct symbolism, and yields most interesting results to meditation when the association chains begin to unfold. The figure of the Virgin has the indigo blue and purple colorings such as are seen in delphiniums, which are characteristic of Yezud. Her dark blue cloak was covered with silver stars and was the color of the night sky. Her underdress was sky blue, and behind her head was the crescent moon, horns upward. At her left side grew a tall spray of Madonna lilies, with one unopened bud and two open flowers. This blue and silver figure stood in the ray of purple light holding the cup. The symbolism of all this becomes more interesting the more we contemplate it. Mary, Queen of Heaven, Star of the Sea, is the Eternal Mother, Ever Virgin. She is the Ever, Virgin and Manifest Feminine Principle of Bina, the Heavenly Isis. She is also Our Lady of Nature, Ever, Fecund. The two shades of blue of her garments signify her dual aspect. The Madonna Lily is the Western analog of the lotus. Those who are familiar with yoga symbolism will remember that when the lotus bud hangs downwards, it indicates that a chakra is in repose, and when the flower opens and turns its face upwards, it indicates that the kundalini force is passing through that chakra. Headline, text to picture. The 9th of June 1940, last week, over 300,000 Allied troops were evacuated from Dunkirk. Britain now faces the imminent threat of invasion. Churchill vows, "We shall fight on the beaches." In the 30th letter, in the period leading up to the summer solstice, a new phase of the work is inaugurated. This is formulated in the development of a complete symbolic complex based upon the Torah at Glastonbury, and detailed instructions on how best to work within it. Letter number 30, for June 9, 1940. It will be remembered that it was during the last meditations before the Whitsuntide holidays that we got the full formula of the triune, thus completing the first phase of our work. With the re-starting of our meditation circle, a new phase is opening, and we are now to build up the vision of the Mount of Illumination, beneath whose roots in earth the cavern is set. This is a traditional glyph of great importance. We saw it for the first time on the Sunday before Whitsuntide, but as no letter was sent out that week, no record of it was available for those who were not present. As has been said before, the cavern, which is the starting point of all our meditations, is conceived of as being situated beneath the holy mountain of the Illuminati. The cavern is entered symbolically by a secret underground way through which alone can access be obtained to its higher aspects, symbolized by the Hall of Learning, conceived of as a great medieval library, and the Chapel of the Graal with its watchtower. These are pictured as situated one above the other, a spiral stair set in the thickness of the rocky walls leading upwards. The cavern is the meeting place in which the brethren assemble. The Hall of Learning symbolizes the acquirement of occult knowledge. The Chapel of the Graal is the place of spiritual power. Concerning the watchtower which rises above it, not a great deal can be said at the moment, save that it is there that the silent watcher, cowled and cloaked, keeps perpetual vigil. In order to make use of this glyph, we commence the meditation as usual upon the cross in the cavern. Then we imagine ourselves climbing the spiral staircase set in the thickness of the wall up to the Hall of Learning. A very interesting use can be made of this symbolic image. The student can imagine himself taking from the shelves with which he is surrounded a book bearing on some question in which he is specially interested, and turning its pages in imagination, try to read what is written therein. He will probably be able to see little more than symbols and a few short sentences, but he will find that in the immediate future, information on a desired subject, and understanding thereof, will come his way as if by chance. This method, of course, cannot be used for mundane matters. Into the Chapel of the Graal we can go to kneel in devotion, to find peace, and to receive spiritual illumination. But if we join in the vigil on the watchtower, we observe the workings of the invisible forces of both good and evil, and it is a position that exposes us to the risk of occult attack. Therefore it is not for the inexperienced. The cavern is the secret place of meeting and of initiation. The concealed underground passage by which it is entered symbolizes the cryptic, guarded, occult nature of the teaching. In the ordinary way only initiates of the mysteries can gain access thereto, but in this time of national crisis and spiritual rebirth we have been able to frank through those who are working with us, relying upon the nature of the forces that operate through these symbols to reject the unworthy. So far our confidence has been amply justified. The work for the next week will be to build up the glyph of the three-chambered mount of illumination and to become familiar with the practice of going from story to story by way of the winding stair. Those who care to do so, can essay the watchtower, but they may find that the winds of astral force are blowing full gale, and the silent watcher is a formidable figure. Headline, text to picture. The 16th of June 1940 German forces pour through the Maginot Line. Allied forces evacuate from Brest and St. Malo. The 31st letter gives a resume of the development of the work so far, together with a little more detail on the practicalities of working with symbolism. And lest any should have any doubts upon the matter, Dion Fortune sets out in clear terms that the performance of esoteric work is no excuse for lack of commitment to outer work in the world. In fact, that to neglect the call of physical plane demands is likely to break the circuit, thus rendering any intended inner plane work ineffective. Letter No. 31, for June 16th, th. 1940. Those who have followed the course of our work from its beginning and seen its growth, know that it was not a thing which had been thought out and planned by human intelligence, but that it was gradually unfolded in a series of visions or revelations, each leading on to the next. The starting point was the simple cross with circle, which symbolizes salvation through knowledge. From it quickly developed the Rose Cross, famous in tradition, of which so little is known historically. Then came the formulation of the cavern beneath the Mount of Illumination where certain of the Elder Brethren came to meet us in the light. Thus was established the astral meeting place for our work. Those who have built up the vision in their imagination till it has become a reality for them, can use it as a taking, offer place for all manner of work on the inner planes, for thus, by means of the establishment of a thought, outform on the astral plane and a chain of associated ideas leading thereto are gates of ingress to the unseen established. Once this gateway and meeting place has been formulated, it can be used for all manner of purposes. During the long pause before the battle was joined, we made use of it to build up a glyph which revealed to us the whole scope and scheme of the plan to which we were working, and of which our war effort constitutes the opening phase. It will be found very useful to have recourse to this glyph in meditation whenever the way seems dark or doubtful, or the burden of war weighs heavy upon us. It is as if a traveler toiling through a dense forest climbed to the topmost branches of a high tree and saw the whole landscape through which he must make his way spread out before him. With the sudden intensification of the war, this glyph was put aside and our efforts concentrated on the bringing through of power and the war effort. Then came a curious development, and we found ourselves, being led from level to level of the Mount of Illumination, and passing through the Hall of Learning and the Chapel of the Graal. Both these mystical representations have their special uses. If we imagine ourselves to be in the Hall of Learning, we can use the contacts thus made to acquire technical occult knowledge in the manner described in a previous letter. If we picture ourselves in the Chapel of the Graal, we find that we are immediately in touch with the most potent spiritual forces. If we mount yet higher, and come out on the watchtower, we shall discover powers of vision are available to us, but that strong and contending forces will beat upon us. On Sunday, in the sanctuary, we found that the strongest contacts were those of the Chapel of the Graal, and that from the vision they received there came a very brilliant and very pure spiritual illumination. In the time of efforts and testing that we are passing through, spiritual strength is needed, both by us as individuals and by the nation as a whole. It is through spiritual strength that we shall triumph over the brute force that opposes us. Nazism has physical and astral and mental powers, but it has no spiritual contacts, hence its lack of all ethical standards and its complete irresponsibility. We, on our part, have the spiritual forces of the cosmos behind us. For these we have to make channels through our own natures. We are, in fact, the channels of their manifestation in exact proportion to our realization of them. As soon as these channels are opened into any plane or sphere, the forces will build forms there for themselves. We do not have to toil at the form, building, we simply have to win the realizations and hold them steadily, then the forces do their own work. We shall see, in the most amazing way, results follow realization. This does not mean that, if we do inner plane work, we have no need to bear our share in the national effort. There will always be those whose inner plane work occupies their whole time, but they are few. Having done our meditations, we should return refreshed and inspired to do with all our might whatever tasks lie to hand.